From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you. You, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, November 1 is the Christian observance of All Saints Day, followed by All Souls Day on Monday. Gosh, it's been a busy week at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Presidential candidate Donald Trump promised to somehow mandate private businesses to force employees to say Merry Christmas to all customers, presumably during the sacred shopping season that is about to begin. He also took a cheap shot at fellow candidate Ben Carson's faith tradition. Carson, meanwhile, won his first national poll after comparing fetuses to slaves and expressing skepticism about the need for any exceptions to a ban on abortion, which he clearly favors. On Wednesday, the third GOP debate left the hapless CNBC moderators as public enemy number one, even as Mike Huckabee refused to impugn Donald Trump as not moral, and Bobby Jindal, yes, somehow he's still in the race, made a blatantly Christian pitch for the presidency in his closing statement. And on a more positive note, the Episcopal Church is installing its new presiding bishop and primate on Sunday. Right Reverend Michael Curry is the first African-American bishop elevated to this post. And a politician whose economic policies have long provoked progressive activists, such as the network lobby, Wisconsin representative and former candidate for the Vice President of the United States, Paul Ryan, was elected Speaker of the House. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
In this country, 91.8% of Congress is Christian.
I'm just telling you, when push comes to shove, they will not stand up for religious liberty.
Religious freedom.
A primary thing to do now is to talk about religious liberty.
Can same-sex marriage and religious liberty coexist?
The Baker's right to freedom of religious expression.
It's remarkable how many different matters have been squashed into the religious liberty frame in recent years. Even as the issue is a matter of life and death in other parts of the world, culture warriors in the United States shamelessly hijack that wording again and again for political and fundraising purposes. This week, a new report from the Center for American Progress attempts to move the conversation beyond exposing these irresponsible efforts to look at concrete steps to combat them. And I'll talk with Sally Steenland, one of the authors, later in the hour.
Like many other places, Modesto is becoming more religiously diverse. But unlike any other place, religion is a required course in high school here.
A new bill aims to cut religious doctrine in Tennessee classrooms after complaints from parents that students are being taught the five pillars of Islam.
It can seem like a complicated topic, even as right-wing Christians demand that we, quote, put God back in our schools. There are also frequent instances where those same voices are raised in outrage at what they perceive as a promotion of Islam and other non-Christian religions in the classroom. In truth, the matter is quite simple. In a pluralistic nation and world, it's nothing short of essential to have an understanding of religions other than our own. At the same time, no religion should be promoted in a public schoolroom. A recently published book brings both wisdom and practical insights to this subject, and I'll be talking with Linda K. Wertheimer, author of Faith Ed, Teaching About Religion in an Age of Intolerance, on this week's State of Belief. But first,
If Proposition 1 passes, you could be fined up to $5,000 for declining to participate in a same-sex wedding or simply objecting to a man using a woman's bathroom.
Well, that's the kind of rhetoric that Houston voters have been inundated with recently, complete with video of U.S. currency being flushed down the toilet as the nation's fourth biggest city braces for a referendum this Tuesday on HERO, the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance. Business interests are among the voices supporting the ordinance. Far-right religious leaders have been at the forefront of a hate-based campaign to defeat it, particularly because faith has gotten dragged once again into a culture war battle. We need to address it on this show. And to do that, I'm joined by Marty Rouse, National Field Director at the Human Rights Campaign, the largest LGBT rights advocacy organization in the country and one that has devoted significant resources to combating faith-based bigotry in general and the anti-hero campaign in particular. Marty, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
HERO has a long and complicated history at this point, but it would be good if you would start with just a brief timeline of how we got to where we are.
Houston is America's fourth most populous city. So what happens in Houston really has national impact. Houston currently has no protections for its LGBT citizens or visitors, and it has no protections citywide for many categories as well. There's only federal protections in the city of Houston. The city council, under Mayor Anise Parker's leadership, did finally pass a non-discrimination ordinance, an equal rights ordinance, that protected 15 classes of people at the municipal level, including people based on their sexual orientation and gender identity, but 15 classes, including race, including religion, military status, pregnancy, religion. And it passed with a rather large margin earlier this year. And unfortunately, opponents of equality and opponents of the mayor actually petitioned and collected signatures to put this on the ballot. The city counted the signatures early this year and ruled that it appeared that there were not enough valid signatures to actually go onto the ballot. However, the state Supreme Court intervened and said this needs to go on to the ballot for public affirmation. And so here we are next Tuesday, and actually starting on October 19th, registered voters of Houston are actually voting on whether or not the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance should be affirmed, should it take effect. And so we expect about 20% of the registered voters of Houston, that's a small number, but 20% of the registered voters are going to be voting on whether or not people are protected at the municipal level in housing, in employment, in public accommodations. And that's going to happen next Tuesday.
Who's screaming the loudest in opposition to the fact that LGBT persons are included under Houston's civil rights ordinance?
Unfortunately, there are several conservative Christian clergy members who are screaming the loudest, and they are the ones who have basically led the charge to put this on the ballot. And so you have some very conservative members saying that this should not be in Houston. So the campaign in support of the Equal Rights Ordinance has made sure that we are finding faith voices to be public and to speak out as well and to basically say we are all God's children.
What are they wanting to do to LGBT people? What rights do they want to deny?
I believe that this all comes down to politics. Mm-hmm. And so there are certain people who, for some reason, are politically interested in making sure that the LGBT community and people who support the LGBT community are not successful, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And so while I do believe that if you actually ask people who are opposing this equal rights ordinance what exactly are they opposed to, they end up talking about transgender issues and having transgender people using public accommodations, mainly restrooms. Mm-hmm. That's been the focal point here in Houston. About the TV ads, the radio ads, focused very much on who gets to use which restroom. Mm-hmm. And so it's unfortunate that you have an equal rights ordinance that protects so many people for so many different reasons, and the opposition are solely focused on scare tactics of basically saying that a man will dress up like a woman and go into a restroom and attack a young girl. That is actually the TV ad that our opponents are running in opposition to this broad-based equal rights ordinance that protects 15 classes of Houstonians. So we're really faced with this battle right now. It's quite painful to watch. Any LGBT person in particular watching these TV ads, it's extremely painful, it's extremely infuriating, and to know that voters are going to vote on whether or not you have the right to a job, whether or not you have the right to use a public restroom, it's really terrible to see everything boil down to a 30-second ad that a lot of people are talking about.
Mm. Our listeners on State of Belief know the Human Rights Campaign because we've done so much work together. But talk about, if you will, the Human Rights Campaign's involvement in this particular initiative.
The Human Rights Campaign worked very closely with local leaders last year as they were preparing to try to pass the ordinance to begin with. So politically, we got involved with political leaders in the city of Houston. Our legal team got involved with the lawyers that were interested in drafting the ordinance. We worked very closely with our allies on the city council and with the mayor, as well with the business leadership of the city of Houston. Houston is a city that is really driven by business, international business. And so we worked with the Houston Chamber of Commerce, which is called the Greater Houston Partnership. Mm-hmm. We worked very close with them in making sure we crafted an ordinance that the business community felt extremely comfortable with, and politically that we worked to make sure it was going to cover the broad ranges of people that needed to be covered and to make sure that the entire LGBT community was completely covered in this ordinance. We then worked very hard to make sure there was a grassroots effort in support of the ordinance, contacting city council members, testifying in front of the city council. So we made sure there was broad and public support and diverse support, working closely with the NAACP and other organizations to make sure there was broad, public, diverse support for the ordinance. And then, in fact, when it got passed, HRC then worked again with our allies to prepare for the potential that it might go to the ballot. And so we have joined with several organizations to form a campaign called Houston Unites, mm-hmm. helping to defend the ordinance. And HRC has already contributed over $400,000 in cash. We currently have 20 HRC staff on the ground in Houston. 14 more are coming this weekend, so we will have 34 full-time HRC staff on the ground, knocking on doors, making phone calls, making sure everybody gets out and votes on Tuesday. We are also donating computers and phones that the campaign has all the technology it needs to reach voters the most efficient way. So from the beginning until the very, very end, the Human Rights Campaign will be working alongside our allies. We're also working very closely with the business community, General Electric, Hewlett-Packard, BBVA Compass Bank, major corporations and large employers in the city of Houston and Texas have announced their support for this equal rights ordinance. And finally, we're working with congregations and making sure that we show that there's diverse faith voices that support this. We had at least 16 congregations talk about HERO on this past Sunday, and after services, they marched to the polling places and voted early in support of the equal rights ordinance. We are also mobilizing the Hollywood community as well. So we have Texas homegrown person Eva Longoria. We have actor Matt Bomer, Matthew Morrison, former NFL draft person Michael Sam. We are getting Hollywood and sports figures and other public figures to announce their support for the Equal Rights Ordinance as well. We had actress Sally Field mm-hmm. in Houston expressing her support and what it means to her as a woman and the mother of a gay son to have this on the ballot, and urging voters in Houston as mothers to go out and vote yes on Proposition 1. So from top to bottom, HRC is doing everything we can do to make sure that the Equal Rights Ordinance gets an affirmative yes vote on Tuesday.
HRC over the years has recognized the importance of progressive people of faith in advancing an agenda of equality. And I'm delighted that once again, you're finding not just a few oppositional people in the religious community, but you're also seeing the best of what a religious community can do to advance equality for everybody.
Absolutely. And the final TV ad of our campaign, the Houston Unites campaign, features a Latino faith leader, and he is the leading person on this 30-second TV ad that just started running on Monday. Oh, that was so long ago. Time flies, but we started running yet on Monday, and it will run until next Tuesday. So, again, we are recognizing the importance of faith voices and how positive a voice they have in the community, and it's very, very important to this campaign.
Marty, we've seen this kind of scaremongering in other places where transgender persons are portrayed as nothing more than potential sexual predators. What is it going to finally take to blunt the power of this kind of propaganda? Because they wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't an effective tactic with certain audiences.
You really ask a very, very important question. And I would say the answer, there's a time to have this conversation and a time to strategize and a time to educate people on how we do this. There's also how you win a campaign. And sometimes those are two different things. So right now we are focused on winning this campaign and getting a yes vote on Tuesday. The larger question about how you do this, first off, I would say that we are winning. As days go by, as months go by, as years go by, the opposition to people that are transgendered is diminishing. And a lot of that is because there are transgender voices speaking up and being identified from mainstream media to your local community. And so the most important thing is to find transgender voices and find ways to make people feel comfortable about talking about their lives. And you cannot underestimate the personalizing of this and how important it is to actually find people who are transgender or affected by people who are transgender, other family members, and have them talk about personally what this means to them. It's not just a personal transition. It's a family transition and a workplace transition. And so it's very important. You know, we're working in another city in Jacksonville, Florida, where one of the city council members that we helped elect because she was supportive of adding gender identity to that city's non-discrimination law, she talked about what it was like for her as an a manager in a large corporation having a top employee go through the physical transition on the job, and she saw the difficulty that she had, and she said, why, when this person is going through her own difficulty on her own personal transition, her place of employment should not be a place where she has problems, and she should be safe and supported in that place of employment. And that helped the city council member be such a strong advocate for gender identity in the city council's law.
Marty Rouse is the National Field Director at the Human Rights Campaign. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's my absolute pleasure, and thank you for talking about this really important topic at this very important time.
Linda K. Wertheimer is a veteran journalist and award-winning education writer. With nuance and expertise, Linda has taken on a contentious issue in today's America. Just published by Beacon Press, her book is Faith Ed, Teaching About Religion in an Age of Intolerance. And I am very pleased it brings Linda K. Wertheimer to State of Belief Radio. Linda, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
I don't have to tell you, this subject can be a real minefield. What made you want to write this book?
Well, there were two reasons. One was personal. I was born in upstate New York, and then when I was 9, we moved to Ohio. And the very first week of school, they had this woman come in and teach us. I'm Jewish, and she gave me that background. So this woman came in, and she taught us Bible classes, all steeped in Christianity, and had us sing Jesus Loves Me. And she was hired by the local churches. And this was in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And I went home, told my parents about it, and they're like, well, that's not right, you know, that's illegal. They went and talked to the school system, who said, well, our community wants these classes, so we'll just excuse your daughter. So they excused me, and then so each week the church lady, I called her the church lady, the church lady came, and I would leave. As soon as she came in, I left, I was escorted out by my teacher, and the kids noticed, and they would say, well, why don't you stay? And I say, well, I'm Jewish. And they said, well, what's that? And I would try to explain, and they said, you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to hell. And I experienced that for many, many years. And in the back of my mind, there was always this question. Was that anti-Semitism, or was it ignorance? Mm-hmm. I always wondered, well, you know, what if the teachers had taught us about many religions instead of one? Mm-hmm. Could that have made a difference? Could that have essentially softened the division? Mm-hmm. So reason two, fast forward, you know, I've now been a journalist for a very long time. It's 2010. I spot a headline in the Boston Globe about Wellesley Middle School. Mm-hmm. And they had taken their kids on a field trip to a mosque. And it turned into this huge uproar. And it's going to sound a little bit like a soap opera, but a parent had been sent in with a video camera by a group that didn't like this mosque. And on this field trip, a worshiper invited a handful of boys to join the line of worshipers. So this parent is catching this on camera. This is the spring of 2010. 3 months later, out comes a video by this group that says, Wellesley public school students learn to pray to Allah. Mm-hmm. And a huge controversy erupted. And I was actually more intrigued by the fact that these sixth graders were spending January to June learning about the world's religion. They were taking field trips to a mosque, to a Hindu mandir. They had guest speakers. They were doing projects. They were having discussions. So I spent like 5 to 6 months shadowing them to find out, well, what is this course about? How did they recover from the controversy? Will they do more field trips? And that sort of got me going on this exploration around the country of the subject.
Linda, what's the model for doing teaching about religion in a way that doesn't end up promoting a particular religion or disparaging one?
I wouldn't say there's one model. Okay, so to give you a couple examples.
Good.
For example, I think Wellesley Middle School is doing a fine job of teaching the children about four different religions. The teachers are trained not to express bias that this one is better or that one's better. The teacher does a very skillful exercise where they, when they're doing comparisons, it's more like, well, what does this religion believe about life and death versus this religion? Or Jesus means what in Christianity versus what does he mean in Islam? Mm-hmm. And it's not, this is a better way to believe. I would also mention Modesto, California, because they've avoided controversy, and they've done this since the year 2000, and they require all high school students to take a world religions course before they graduate. And it's 9 weeks long, and they actually worked with the religious communities in some respect to deal with some of the questions you just raised. Mm-hmm. And they let them look at the textbook, and the textbook actually has the same number of pages per religion. Mm-hmm. And they probably go farther than any district I know to try to be as objective as they can to avoid controversy. They don't do field trips. They don't bring in guest speakers. They don't try on things. And it seems weird to say objective when you're talking about religion, but it really is an objective treatment. They're, mm-hmm. they're dealing with sort of the basic facts that most people can agree on, mm-hmm. on each religion.
Linda, some people looking at the title of the book could make the assumption that this is just a book for administrators in school and for people who teach in that particular area. I know you wrote it with a larger audience in mind. Tell us who was in your mind when you wrote the book.
So obviously, yes, educators were in my mind. Parents were in my mind. Teenagers were in my mind. And faith communities, all kinds of faith communities were in their mind because they need to be a part of this discussion in terms of how we're teaching about religion in the public school, mm-hmm. because it's their religion that's being taught. And, you know, I've been doing probably one or two talks a week now, mm-hmm. about the book, and I'm getting tons of invitations to speak from churches, from mm-hmm. mosques, and from temples and churches of different branches. So it's really resonating with religious community.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is the book is, it's twofold. I mean, first of all, it has my own story wrapped into it.
Mm-hmm.
But second of all, it tells the stories of religious minorities across the country and what their experiences are. So it's a narrative nonfiction book. It's not a textbook. It's not an academic book.
If everything went just as you want it to go, what would you like a reader of the book to come away from? How should that person leave after reading your book? What do you want them feeling?
Number one, I want them to feel more empathy, mm-hmm. for those of us in this country who aren't Christian.
Mm-hmm.
and to look around them and see who's in their community and understand that even if you think you live in a community that's 100% Christian, it may not be.
Mm-hmm.
And I want the book, one, to raise more awareness about the religious minorities in this country, which mm-hmm. is a growing group. Mm-hmm. I mean, along with that are the people who, atheists are growing, agnostics are growing as well.
Right.
So, number one, I guess I wanted to create empathy. That's sort of a, you know, a mushy mm-hmm. part of it. Number two, I want them to come away with a feeling that if they're a parent, I need to check with my school and say, you know, how are they teaching about religion? And are they actually doing enough?
Mm-hmm.
Could they do more?
Mm-hmm.
And could they go younger? I mean, I want to raise questions in people's minds. Like, you know, how young can we go with this?
Mm-hmm.
Given that kids are experiencing the bullying about religion when they enter the schoolhouse door, how young can we go? And is it okay to go as young as first grade? I think mm-hmm. it is. And I get a lot of pushback on that point.
Sure.
When religion is introduced in the classroom as a subject to be studied and understood, what do you want the student to feel?
In my book, I talk to tons of students because I feel that they're actually the most important voice in this book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want them to feel empowered in a way, you know, empowered that I can learn about other religions in school.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm a religious minority, it's okay to talk about it with another kid
mm-hmm.
and not be embarrassed or ashamed or scared. You know, I want the religious minorities to feel like there's someone in their corner, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I want those in the majority to not be so afraid to ask someone who's a religious minority a question about their religion. These classes actually open dialogue between kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't sometimes happen right in the class. Sometimes it happens a couple years later as they mature.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to push it one more step because I'm thinking about the student sitting there that has grown up in a family of nuns, the N-O-N-E-S. Mm-hmm. What will you want that student to feel?
So, and I did interview students who describe themselves as atheist or agnostic.
Uh-huh.
I can't generalize because I didn't interview enough to say I talked to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So the one that I talked to in Wellesley said he loved the class and that for him it was just merely learning about religion, different religions. It didn't make him want to adopt a religion.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an education. There was an example in the Modesto chapter of an atheist kid who sat there the first day and was like, oh, I don't want to take this class. I don't want to know any. I don't care about religion. I don't want to do this. I think it was a young girl, and she actually changed her mind after the teacher spoke with her about why learning about religion can help you understand, like, just even the news that's going on in our world and help you understand maybe some of the people around you. So I think it's important that they understand that this is teaching about religion. It's not preaching.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is once they kind of get that point, they're okay with it.
And it's a part of quality education for everybody in that sense.
Yes. I mean, I talk about the idea that we need to raise religiously literate Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what this is about.
That's a good line, and we're going to have to stop there. Linda K. Wertheimer is a veteran journalist and award-winning education writer. Her new book is called Faith Ed, Teaching About Religion in an Age of Intolerance. It's an important book, Linda, and I really want to thank you for being with us today so we learn more about it on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Bakers, florists, county clerks, proselytizing military officers, Bible-thumping coaches, and public school teachers. If you listen to the religious right, those and many others are the victims of the most egregious assault on religious liberty in history. Of course, if you scratch the surface of virtually all of these stories, you'll find instead blatant violations of constitutional principles and one-sided demands for the right to discriminate. But all too often, the surface doesn't get scratched. And even if it does, there's not much hope that these divisive strategies are going away anytime soon. Offering some hopeful strategies to move beyond this stalemate, which benefits the few but ultimately harms all of us by polarizing Americans in a way that is patently un-American, is a new report from the Center for American Progress titled Restoring the Balance, A Progressive Vision of Religious Liberty Preserves the Rights and Freedoms of All Americans. And joining me right now is one of the report's authors, Sally Steenland, Director of CAP's Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative. Sally, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's so good to be talking with you again.
The report is titled Restoring the Balance. When do you think we lost the balance on this issue, or did we ever have it?
Well, I think at one point there probably was a good balance, and you can probably answer that question better than me. If we go back to 1993, when the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed, which is being wildly misused these days, both federally and by the courts and in states. But back then, it was an attempt to be sensitive to people's religious expression, to following your beliefs and practicing your beliefs in your everyday life, while also being very careful that those beliefs do not impinge on the rights of others, do not cause discrimination, or don't force others to believe things that go contrary to their conscience. So it's been a very delicate balance. It's not like one size fits all or here's a simple answer. These are complicated matters. But we've been doing it. And what we've been seeing in states, and most recently a year ago, last June, in the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision, is, in our view, a wild misreading of what RFRA ever intended, so that balance is now tipped and we're not in a good place.
Yeah. So when you look at the religious liberty rhetoric as it's been used recently in this country, do you see certain patterns that emerge?
A pattern we see emerging is what culminated in Hobby Lobby, and what we saw really start to pick up speed and traction was when the Affordable Care Act passed, and it included a contraceptive mandate as part of preventive health care for women. So what that means is if you're an employer and you offer a whole range of health care to your employees, one of those is preventive care for women, and that includes, you know, wellness training and diabetes screening, mammogram checkups, pap smears, things like that. But it also includes contraceptive coverage because we know how important that is to women's health and how cost-effective that is. And we also know that 99% of women have used contraception at some point in their life, and most people see it as a great public health victory and something that people just really need to make their families work and to make their families strong and healthy. So when the Catholic bishops and some other conservatives opposed that, they really couldn't say, we're against contraception, because that wouldn't get any traction. So that's where we started to see the religious liberty rhetoric, to give you high moral ground, to say it's not about contraception, it's about our conscience. And whenever you hear that, in somebody's denial of doing something, that's your ears should always perk up and say, what is this really about? Mm-hmm. And then try to translate and decipher and figure out what really might be at stake, because very often someone's rights are being infringed upon, and rather than arguing on that ground, religious liberty becomes the go-to answer.
When this religious liberty rhetoric is used, and it's really not even close to what the Constitution means when it uses the religious liberty language, who came up with their definitions? I mean, they surely know that's not what the Constitution says. It's not about religious liberty for one group of people. It's about religious liberty for all people. How do they get away with changing the definition that grows out of the Constitution?
I think they kept stretching and stretching and stretching it till it became kind of ludicrous and absurd. So, for instance, I would hope, agree that this country should be reasonably flexible in accommodating people's religious beliefs if they don't impose a really substantial burden on the public. So, for instance, if you are Jewish and you need to leave your workplace before sundown on Friday, many workplaces accommodate that. That's simply a policy. If you are Muslim and you pray five times a day, many workplaces, including ours at the Center for American Progress, we have a prayer room where Muslim employees can go and pray. That's an accommodation that feels very fair and that allows one to practice and exercise one's belief. Now, what a lot of conservatives and right-wing groups have done, they have really sort of twisted and distorted that to mean something quite different. Mm-hmm. So rather than exercising their religion, here's what they're asking for now. What they're saying is, it would be me saying to you, Welton, you're doing something that I don't like. And if you do what I don't like, that offends my religious liberty. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's not anything I'm doing. I'm trying to stop you from exercising your conscience and your First Amendment rights. Right. Because if you do what I say, that's an offense to me. And that's the contraceptive use, that's around marriage equality, that's all those things. So if you see how coercive that is and how that has completely flipped over from me practicing my faith mm-hmm. to stopping you from practicing yours.
Hmm. Is there a sample case that you could highlight that really clarifies what we're talking about in terms of religious liberty arguments?
Well, there are two incidents that I can think of that have happened in this past year in a post-Hobby Lobby world where people have refused to do things that they should be doing and claiming religious freedom or religious liberty grounds. And I just want to say also, what we should stay alert to in 2016 is any state activity where someone is claiming a religious refusal, a religious exemption. I don't want to do this because of my faith, and the effect of that would be discrimination or harming somebody else. I think we're unfortunately going to see a number of those. But the two cases that I would mention, one was out in Utah, which was a fundamentalist sect of the Mormon Church, which had walnut farms, and they were using child laborers to harvest the walnuts, mm-hmm. and it was violating state child labor laws. So there was an investigation by the state agency requiring the head of this sect to testify in court to see if, in fact, they had violated child labor laws, and he refused to testify. Because he said that one of the tenets of his religion was secrecy and not discussing the church's beliefs in public, in a courtroom setting, was in public, and it went against his violation to even testify, and he refused to do it, and he cited RFRA in the post-Hobby Lobby world. So that's pretty egregious. And then the second one, also very troubling, happened this summer in Michigan, where two women had a child, and they had picked their pediatrician before the baby was born, a pediatrician they wanted. And when the baby was, I believe, 7 days old, they took her to the pediatrician for her first appointment. And when the pediatrician saw that this infant, who she was, you know, licensed in the Hippocratic Oath to care mm-hmm. for, saw that she had two mothers, she refused to care for her, saying that it violated her religious beliefs. So again, you see a doctor refusing to care for an infant because she objects to the configuration of that baby's family.
Goodness gracious. I think this report is so good for one reason, because it's not just descriptive, it's also prescriptive. And I'd like for you to talk about the ways you see us being able to move beyond the current stalemate.
Sure. So there are at least three things we can do, and we're working on all of them. I mean, one of them is to fix the federal RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It would just be an amendment. We're calling it the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to restore RFRA to its original intent, to amend RFRA so that it is a robust expression of free exercise of religion, but not when it causes material third-party harm to other people. And that's just another way of talking about the Establishment Clause, actually, just saying that there have always been limits to religious freedom. So that would be one, to amend the federal RFRA. And then the other is, as you know, LGBT Americans have celebrated some wonderful victories, including the Supreme Court marriage equality decision this past June. But the battle is far from over. And what we say is, you can get married on Sunday and fired on Monday. And so what does not exist in this country are federal non-discrimination laws in housing and public accommodations to protect LGBT Americans against discrimination at the local, the state, and the federal law. And there's a law that's been introduced called the Equality Act. And so this law needs to become law. The good news is that most Americans think we already have a law. It's kind of shocking to people that we don't have one. And so we just need to make that thought a reality. And then we also need to pass state laws to increase access to preventive health care services for women, because whether it's a contraceptive mandate or whatever it might be, people are using religious refusals. Pharmacists refusing to provide contraceptive services to women because it goes against their beliefs, and just basic health care being in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And so women just need, again, access to that basic health care. It's really important for progressives, for progressive people of faith, especially to call their congresspeople, to call their local representatives, and to say, this is bad legislation. I'm a Presbyterian, I'm a Methodist, I'm a Baptist. We believe in religious liberty for everybody. So it's important to get the voices heard, and whether you're at your book group, at your workplace, in your neighborhood, at your church, whatever it might be, to actually talk about this issue so that people have a sense of one can be for religious liberty, be a strong proponent of religious liberty, but not before these discriminatory measures.
Sally, how can our listeners get their hands on this Center for American Progress project?
AmericanProgress.org, and the report itself is called Restoring the Balance. Just go on our website and you can download it from there. And it's the whole report as well as an executive summary with the recommendations and everything.
Sally Steenland is the director of the Center for American Progress Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative. Sally, thank you for making time to be with us on State of Belief.
Well, thank you so much for letting us, you know, share this with your listeners, because we do this work inside our offices and it's really important to have your megaphone. So I thank you for that.
Now, before we go, I simply have to ask the question, does anybody care about the Constitution anymore? I'm really serious. Many of the news stories I've read and heard this past week have disturbed me greatly. Last Saturday, while campaigning in Iowa, Donald Trump questioned the legitimacy and integrity of presidential candidate Ben Carson's religion, while he boasted about the superiority of his own religion. Carson's a Seventh-day Adventist. Trump is a Presbyterian. Keep in mind that Trump is the candidate who alluded to the little cracker he liked to eat in church that made him feel better, unable to speak reverently about Holy Communion in his tradition, and then displayed not even an elementary knowledge of the Bible, neither of which disqualified him from running for president, but certainly raised questions about his credibility as a critic of someone else's religion. Trump simultaneously jeopardized his credibility to boast about Presbyterianism, a faith he described as down the middle of the road. According to Trump, Carson's religion is suspect because the armchair, self-appointed theologian named Trump didn't know about Seventh-day Adventists. I just don't know, Trump complained with innuendo. Why was Donald Trump suddenly talking about religion so fervently? I think a pretty safe guess would be that his motivation had much more to do with politics and the decline in Trump's status in political polls than about religious orthodoxy. Also, during that same weekend, Trump promised, when I'm in office, every store will be saying Merry Christmas. Well, here again, a reality check is in order. No president has the authority to make that happen. No president with any understanding of the most religiously diverse nation in the world would write off all religions other than Christianity. But Trump's boast raises a critically important question related to all candidates seeking the presidency. Why would anyone running for the presidency make such a promise, knowing that to be sworn into the office of the presidency requires a vow to defend the Constitution that includes a prohibition against legislation or any other action that attempts to establish one religion over another or religion over non-religion and attempts to impose religion on people by government authority? Of course, Trump is not the only presidential candidate in the primary elections who has been so dismissive of religious freedom and the Constitution in which it is assured for all Americans. Others, such as Ted Cruz, Bobby Jindal, and Mike Huckabee, have actually encouraged their followers to refuse to obey rulings of the Supreme Court in our nation. Ironically, while Trump was questioning Carson's faith tradition and playing to a crowd of people who advocate that only members of the majority religion in the land should be granted religious freedom, walking in the footsteps of his competitor from Arkansas, Carson called for an amendment to the Constitution that would enshrine as a law to be obeyed by all Americans a belief that is held in his own religion. Look, friends, our nation is not electing a pastor in chief or an executive religious leader who holds some other title. We the people are charged with electing the president and commander in chief of our nation who is required to uphold the Constitution. Thankfully, framers of our Constitution, having experienced the abuse of religion and the need for religious freedom, wrote into the Constitution of this Republic a prohibition against using any religious test for determining who can run for a public office. They knew that throughout history, when government and religion have become institutionally entangled, government has lost its vitality and religion has lost its integrity. Not even trying to win election to the highest office in our government justifies threatening the authority of our Constitution. A political campaign is no place for religious rhetoric that jeopardizes religious freedom as defined in our Constitution. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. For almost 10 years now, State of Belief has been bringing stories and voices that you're not going to hear anywhere else to listeners across the country. Long-time listeners occasionally ask us why we now make a direct request for financial support in every show. The answer is simple. We've always depended on listener donations, but for years, a lot of listeners didn't know that. It took this host a long time to overcome not wanting to talk about money on the show, but it's important for you to know how crucial your support is and how grateful I am for every financial donation. As the end of the year gets closer, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and to Interfaith Alliance. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, please, please share it with them. It's very easy to do on Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.